Artists and arts venues have been strained financially and creatively during the pandemic.
The pandemic has kind of taken the wind out of a lot of professional artists and the institutions that are supposed to be supportive of us even in our darkest moments.
But some federal relief for the arts sector could be on the way. I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's today on The Takeaway for Wednesday, December 23rd. Also on the show, Major League Baseball is adding the stats of thousands of Negro League baseball players to their record books, but some see the move as a limited acknowledgement of the league's racist history. And we end the hour with some hope, and we hear from you about the people who helped you make it through 2020.
Tillery Women's Help Center, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jerry, Susie, and Bruce.
I just want to give a shout out to my colleague, Natasha.
Okay, everyone, let's get started. On Tuesday night, President Trump lashed out against the $900 billion congressional stimulus package that passed in both the House and the Senate. The president called for an increase in direct payments to Americans from $600 to $2,000, a request that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said the Democratic Party supports. And while the current stimulus deal is viewed by both parties as a major compromise, there are some sectors of the economy that do stand to benefit from it, including arts venues and institutions across the country. One section of the proposed stimulus bill, the Save Our Stages Act, will make $15 billion available for performing arts funding. Some venues on the brink of closure may be able to hold out a little longer and avoid shutting their doors for good. But according to the National Independent Venue Association, the live music industry alone has lost an estimated $33 billion in revenue this year, which means that much more assistance is still needed in order to keep artists afloat nationwide. Joining me now is Melia Bensusan, the artistic director of Hartford Stage, a regional theater in Hartford, Connecticut. Melia, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Aaron Flagg, a trumpet player, professor at the Juilliard School of Music, and the chair of the League of American Orchestras Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Committee, is back with us. Aaron, welcome to you.
Hey, pleasure to be with you today.
Melia, you run the Hartford Stage, a regional theater in Hartford, Connecticut. How has the pandemic affected your theater?
Oh, you know, I cannot overstate what this pandemic has done to us, right? I mean, I've been at the helm of this theater for a year and a half. And during this pandemic, we have lost 70% of our staff. We've lost more than 60% of our overall revenue this year from last year. And it's just been, you know, on the verge of catastrophic. And I would say if you had spoken to me even a month ago, I would have said I wasn't sure if Hartford Stage was going to survive. We've been incredibly lucky in our community and our board, and we're receiving now quite a bit of support. So we are optimistic about moving ahead, but the number of individual lives affected by this, the unemployment of brilliant theater craftspeople and artisans and artists, all of whom have been let go and have no health insurance on top of everything else, it's just where we've been decimated.
Melia, do you, we understand that this proposed Save Our Stages Act will make $15 billion available for performing arts funding across the country. Will your Hartford Stage benefit from any of that?
We hope so. And we're certainly grateful for the state and federal support. And the Save Our Stages Act could very well be a lifeline. But as you mentioned, you know, we don't know if it's completely passed yet at this moment. And also, you know, the 5,000 pages, it's going to take us a while to figure out what we can access and how. I know that part of the language is about loss and earned and contributed income and so forth. So it really, the devil's in the details here. I guess what I would stress is that we're incredibly grateful for government support, but no one should think that your favorite arts and culture organizations are now saved. Individuals, corporations, and foundations will, we hope, take confidence in the public investment, right? And sort of, in a way, this should be the beginning of people understanding how in need all your beloved arts organizations are, your small museums, your orchestras, your theaters, your dance companies. Everyone's on the verge of really disappearing from the cultural landscape of this country.
Aaron, that's a pretty profound statement from Melia right there. Your thoughts on that, and how has the pandemic hit classical musicians and orchestras?
Well, my take is I tend to have a balanced one, and no disrespect to the real realities laid out by my colleague, but I also see very much the creativity of artists and the resilience of artists, to be it jazz musicians performing in the cities, in the parks, in their driveways, creating concerts wherever we can, the New York Philharmonic, driving throughout the city to share music, as many other orchestras are doing, and the use of the internet to create other businesses. There are theater artists doing plays through Zoom and creating new revenue and in many ways expanding their audiences. We just did a performance at Juilliard of six of our jazz ensembles that we simply broadcast on Instagram Live because space and audiences obviously couldn't be with us. And there were over 500 people around the world who were watching that, which more than doubled what we would have had in a hall. So I see opportunity after the pandemic for arts organizations and arts artists, individual performing artists, teaching artists, storytelling artists who are finding ways to reach their audiences through technology and innovation that will, I believe, become part of the new normal once we move through this horrible period of time. But in terms of classical orchestras, jazz ensembles, all types of ensembles, it is a difficult time indeed. But I see many people focused on figuring out how can we continue to be what we are to society, which are the creators, the storytellers. How do we continue to provide opportunities for collective sharing of ideas and creativity? And that is our role. But as was pointed out by my colleague, Melia, the fact that the federal government just is now added in the second round this Save Our Stages provision also demonstrates the current value proposition and priority that our society places on the arts. And I would also add in arts education. And that should be a wake-up call to all of us in the field to remain vigilant about advocating for the importance of the arts to our physical and mental well-being, as well as to the economic impact that the arts plays in so many cities and locales in this country.
You know, Aaron, to your point, it did strike me that this funding was included in this version of the latest stimulus package. We'll see if that ultimately ends up being passed. But the fact that it was included, to both of your points, actually does signal, I think, a sign that it is important, at least at the federal level. But I'm wondering, Aaron, does or will this congressional stimulus package mean anything for musicians and orchestras across the country? Will it translate into enough financial support beyond what you described already, which are individual efforts to stay afloat?
Well, that's a really great question. And as we all know, this particular package is only designed for the next 3 months. And many of the elements of it, the PPP and Save Our Stages, really only go up till March 14th. So we're talking about 3 months when we all know that many of our venues are not projecting to really fully reopen till the vaccine is, you know, fully implemented across the country. And we're talking into the next fall or next winter. And so 3 months is a step, but that simply is not going to be enough. Unfortunately, the incoming Biden-Harris administration has made, I think, the important note that this is just a step. You know, this is not the last steps of need for the field. And that's hopeful because March 14th is great and that's really helpful. But remember, this support, particularly the PUA and the FPUC monies, which are unemployment assistance monies, stopped back in July. And this is simply to restart them through March. So it is a small step, an important and much appreciated step. But my colleague mentioned, it's important for us to continue advocating for the importance of these industries and the need to sustain us through this COVID period.
Melia, Broadway here in New York City, the center of the theater world, at least in this country, has been dark since March. And I think people expected to return a lot faster, and it still has not. And the theaters, you know, the Great White Way is not open for business. Has that had a ripple effect throughout the theater and arts community across the country?
It has. It's had an enormous effect. And I feel terrible. I feel like I'm the voice of doom on this call, and I don't mean to be, because I completely agree that individual artists are continuing to create and make and sing and act, and we've created more access through online programming, all of us working hard to transform our work that way. But as you point out, Broadway being dark, the percentage of income that comes to artists and artist support organizations, such as the labor unions, Actors Equity, and SDC, the Society for Directors and Choreographers, Broadway is the major source of income for those unions. So we're seeing these unions laying off crucial staff that's helped build them up. We're seeing artists who've never had to worry about health insurance suddenly without health insurance. And we're going to feel the repercussions of this lack of income, right? This incredible shutting off of support for so many people. I think we're going to feel that for years. I mean, you're seeing beloved restaurants in the theater district about to go under. I mean, it's that whole, the whole ecosystem that Broadway has really supported. And this is not to say that artists are stopping being creative. It's simply that their livelihood is disappearing, not their creativity, right? I mean, it's an interesting juxtaposition we have of how much individual creativity has been expressed at this time, and yet how little systemic support there has been for artists.
Aaron, to that point, I mean, have the musicians' unions also taken a hit?
Oh, definitely, because as Amelia points out correctly, many of the artist unions, of course, are financially tied, if you will, to, you know, their largest revenue generators in their field. So musicians' unions, be it Broadway as well, also some of the orchestras in terms of their taxes that they pay through employee benefits and union memberships, are certainly taking a hit. And it also is a call for the field, broadly in my perspective, to work together. As we've seen many of the foundations, the Mellon Foundation and others, who have worked overtime and coming out with record amount of grants, in Mellon's case, to 186 organizations, $228 million in just the last month and a half or so of their work, partnering with other foundations to figure out how can we identify the neediest parts of our sector, be they smaller regional companies, BIPOC organizations, and others, to figure out how to sustain as many organizations as possible. So it is a major hit, and it's an existential moment, and I don't want to understate that. At the same time, I've seen organizations across our sector respond in ways that are incredibly innovative and creative. Jazz and Lincoln Center's recent holiday shows, the amount of content that they continue to push out is amazing.
We got this message from one artist about his experience during the pandemic.
My name is Cameron McKinney, and I'm a professional choreographer and the artistic director of Kizuna Dance, based in New York City. And the pandemic has affected my work in a lot of ways. I mean, besides just the general losing of gigs that we had planned, I mean, even a year ahead of time, the pandemic has kind of taken the wind out of a lot of professional artists and the institutions that are supposed to be supportive of us, even in our darkest moments. I think the federal government in general doesn't support artists in the United States as much as they could and as they should. I'm actually a proponent of creating a position, you know, something similar to the Secretary of the Arts, that has someone who is in a higher place of power that would come to the job with some kind of a greater understanding of what it's like to function in a gig economy, which is what a lot of artists do.
With me still are Melia Bensusan, the artistic director of Hartford Stage, and Aaron Flagg, professor at the Juilliard School of Music. Melia, when we hear from Cameron McKinney, who is a dancer, a choreographer, who's had the pandemic really taken the wind out of his sail, he asks for something that I think I've heard some folks call for, which is essentially a federal level position, arts and culture position. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, I completely agree. And I believe Jeremy O'Harris, you know, the extraordinary playwright who came onto the scene with Slave Play, has been advocating for this very publicly. And I think it's crucial because we need to, you know, there's been all this language around essential workers. And we absolutely, as a nation, have acknowledged or need to even further acknowledge what has been essential in getting us through this pandemic. But when will we agree that artists are also essential workers, right? And so this is part of the conversation of how do we use this moment, as dark as it is, as a wake-up call to the fact that this country has underappreciated, underfunded, and undersupported all the extraordinary artists and artistic institutions that exist here. So I love the idea of a cabinet position of this sort and kind of reevaluating how crucial the many languages of the arts are to our experiences, to be human, to create a culture, to do our EDI work. I mean, all of this is intertwined with our ability to see ourselves reflected, to feel empathy, all of our connections to each other and to ourselves. Come through the arts. How do we make that plea? How do we help our communities, our state and federal governments understand how essential we are to the life of this nation?
Erin, what do you think the pandemic has revealed about how we value, or whether I should ask even if we value art in this country in all of its forms, when it comes to theater, poetry, music, dance, visual arts, the performing arts? What does it say about us as a country?
Well, my first reaction to that question is, what does it say about us as human beings? And my reaction is that it reaffirms the importance of the arts, because we all need community. And the fact that we have all been sheltered and locked down is just as people, unable to interact with society in the way we're used to, undergirds the need we have for each other to be in community, to share stories. How many times I've gone out in my backyard and started to play and the neighbors just gather. There's just a need, there's a desire, not just about, say, my playing or my band's playing, but just to be together. And I think the appreciation for the arts in all its many facets, as an audience member, as a performer, as anyone working in the field, is now heightened because of the fact that we've been kept from that. And so I also think, the way I look at it, in terms of the field coming more together. You know, we're all working on our individual things, but to realize that the arts sector needs to partner, that we have similar needs, similar concerns. And I think us coming together as a field, funders coming together around the importance of the arts, are all steps that I think optimistically can hopefully lead to this idea of a cabinet level official, which has been talked about for 12 years. I remember Quincy Jones talking about that back in 2008, 2009. So the fact that that keeps coming up makes me think, what is holding us from that? And part of that is the value in society of the arts in general. But I also think there's some work in our sector about coming together, that through this pandemic and through the stimulus package that has been discussed, I've seen on Capitol Hill, through the work of the League of American Orchestras and TCG, the Theater Communication Group, a lot more working together in common cause, I think, which is frankly a positive. There are not many positives with this COVID situation, of course, but I think if the arts as a sector can see the need to work together and learn how to do that even better, then we together can help the country really realize the importance and the essential nature of the arts in this country.
Melia, I'll give you the last word. What can people do to support local artists or artists in general, even if they're not able to give performance in person?
Well, I think the sort of call to check in online on the arts organizations that matter to you, because I think it's true. It's remarkable how much work is happening virtually. And to donate. I mean, no amount is too small at this moment, and to advocate even with your neighbors in your community for the value of the arts organizations that are in your neighborhood that are important to you. They need to know, the leaders of those organizations, the artists in your neighborhood need to know that they're important to you.
Melia Bensusan is the artistic director of the Hartford Stage, and Aaron Flagg is a professor at the Juilliard School of Music. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Last Wednesday, Major League Baseball announced it would officially elevate the Negro Leagues to Major League status. That means the MLB will recognize statistics and records from the roughly 3,400 black players who played in the Negro Leagues from 1920 to 1948. The move is an attempt by the league to directly acknowledge the achievements of these players who were systematically excluded from Major League Baseball. And while the change has been met with some praise, others are viewing it as an attempt to sweep baseball's history of racism under the rug. ESPN senior writer Howard Bryant criticized the decision last week, saying, quote, "The Negro Leagues and the scattered and incomplete logbook is and always will be the game's eternal burden. The sport must carry it, and it cannot be undone." Joining me now to discuss is Mark Carrig, a national baseball writer for The Athletic. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's been 100 years since the Negro Leagues began. Why is the MLB doing this now?
Well, I think given the events of the summer, and sort of the attention being paid to this conversation about Black Lives Matter, you know, the idea of social injustice, I think that brought it to the forefront. There's also an anniversary at play here. This is the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Negro Leagues. So I think Major League Baseball, spotting that timing, you know, felt compelled to start looking at this a little bit closer. There had been some talk about it a few months ago. And so, as you say, it happened last Wednesday where it became official. In baseball speed, that's awfully fast, really over just the course of a few months. So I think you're seeing a convergence here of, you know, a centennial anniversary. Also, you've had, you know, the tone and tenor of the country at this point, I think, pushed them toward this move.
Mark, are there many Negro League players even left to witness this happening?
No, there aren't. The time period that Major League Baseball is recognizing is 1920 to 1948. And the Negro Leagues actually persisted for several years after 1948. And so there are players in that later group that are around. But certainly as you go further back to the period of time that Major League Baseball is designating here, I think it's really, you know, not a lot of guys at all, you know, maybe 5-10 guys maybe from that time period. So it's a relatively small group.
We should look at this with somewhat a little bit of skepticism here. Is this an attempt by Major League Baseball to monetize on the Negro Leagues?
You know, I think you could see it that way for sure, because what Major League Baseball has done to lots of parts of the game is kind of bring it under one umbrella. So I think the Negro Leagues fit into that. The current minor leagues fit into that. There's a big controversy within the sport right now about a reorganization that MLB is undergoing that affects the minor leagues. And so I think it speaks to the nature of the game itself. You know, this entity that we know as MLB is relatively new. Before that, baseball had been broken down into a lot of independent organizations, right? The two leagues in baseball were once independent organizations. So I think what the Negro Leagues and how they fit in to that bigger puzzle, I think is a part of this too. And so, yeah, there's probably going to be an element of monetizing this. I think mostly, though, it fits under just getting everything under the same umbrella, which has been a bigger goal of the league here for the last 20 years.
Mark, in order for these stats and records to go on the books, so to speak, there was a lot of research that had to happen in order to get that information. Tell me a little bit about the project that really took place in order to accumulate all that data.
So Negro League data is scattered and very difficult to come by. And I think that's partly a result of the systemic racism that we're talking about. The leagues really had to survive, and a lot of times barely did so. So I think oftentimes there wasn't the financial resources, for instance, to have official record keeping. So what researchers have done over a very long period of time, we're talking 3-4 decades here, an army of researchers have gathered primary sources, newspapers, box scores, and have assembled as best they can these lost seasons. So it's really been a process of gathering a lot of far-flung data and then trying to make sense of it, which, as we know, these are imperfect procedures. It's an inexact science to do so. But to their credit, they've been able to recapture, I think it's 73% of games that would be counted by MLB. So that's a big number, and it's certainly larger than it was even 2 years ago.
What about off the field? Has Major League Baseball acknowledged their treatment of the Negro Leagues or ignoring the Negro Leagues?
So that's actually been talked about a lot after this announcement was made. You know, even the word elevate, which was used in the press release, sends a message that I don't think they were intending to send. And then also, when you look at the press release, there's a feeling that they're trying to absolve themselves a bit of this. For instance, this decision to not recognize the Negro Leagues earlier was called an error, a mistake. And I think that wording takes away responsibility. I mean, that was a decision by organized baseball not to do so in real time. So that is not some kind of omission. That is an active attempt to ignore this league, to deny it its existence. And I think that's a major distinction that, you know, I think raised some eyebrows amongst people who pay close attention to these things.
What about the family members and the descendants of Negro League players? Will there be some sort of compensation for them, given that the players themselves are, many, if not almost all of them, are not alive to have this moment and to relish in this moment?
So after the announcement of this news, I think there was an initial feeling of goodwill, because on the surface, I think that acknowledgement was long overdue. And most historians and scholars that study the game and study this era would agree with that. Now, what happened after that initial enthusiasm is people start to ask the question, okay, well, what does this mean? And I think by and large, there aren't any answers to that. It feels like this was a decision made without thinking through some of the details, and one of those includes compensation, or what does this mean for pensions, and, you know, what does this mean for the people that, you know, either survive or the descendants of the players that are impacted by this. And frankly, I don't think there are any clear answers right now. In fact, that seems to be an overall theme with this whole thing, is that, yes, this is a designation that was long overdue, but in practice, I'm not sure anybody knows exactly what it's going to mean, and that even includes how these statistics get represented in the books moving forward.
Mark Carrick is a senior writer for The Athletic. Mark, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
You.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. And we're almost at the end of 2020, and boy, it's been a year. I've had some tough years, but 2020 has definitely been one of the hardest, and I know I'm not alone. And even though people are starting to get the vaccine, by many estimations, we're still going to have a long way to go before life can go back to relatively normal. So we're going to take some time today to talk about hope and resilience and those things that got us through the collective trauma and devastation of 2020. And for many of you, like me, help and support came from unexpected places.
Hi to the veteran representative at the Brooklyn Tillery Women's Help Center. Thank you so much for reaching out to me during the COVID lockdown. It lifted my spirits and made me hopeful again. Feliz Navidad, Happy New Year. Retired Sergeant Butler Maria, out.
I just want to give a shout out to my colleague Natasha, because she really carried me this semester. We're both public high school math teachers, and it was incredibly difficult managing all the new software and the lesson plans and trying to do it well. So her help was invaluable, and I'm so grateful.
I share property with four other people here in Point Reyes Station, California. We have been eating dinner together every night for 5-6 years. We laugh with each other so hard. It's remarkable every single night. And saved my bacon. Thank you, Jerry, Susie, and Bruce.
Sonia Lott is a licensed psychologist specializing in grief. Sonia, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hi.
And the Reverend Jackie Lewis is the senior minister at Middle Collegiate Church in New York City. Jackie, thanks for joining us again.
I'm so glad to be with you. Thank you.
Jackie, your congregation had a fire that destroyed the church building. Do you ever feel like your faith was being tested in moments like this? And what did you say to congregants who were having trouble keeping their faith, particularly when they saw the building just burn?
Thank you for that question. I'd say 2020 in total has been a wild, horrific, hot mess of a year. But faith is for just a time as this. Faith is for the times of grief. Faith is for the times when a fire burns down your building. And what I've said to my congregation is what I say to myself. We're going to grieve. We're going to cry. We're going to mourn. We're going to find joy in the mourning. The mourning, the grief is the healing process. So to feel it fully, to not be ashamed of it, to embrace it and walk through it together as a community.
Sonia, so it's okay to cry and feel these feelings?
Absolutely. It's essential to moving through and integrating your grief.
What's the difference, Sonia, between faith and hope? And Jackie, I'm going to ask you the same question.
I spent a lot of time really thinking about that question, because we sometimes use them interchangeably, but hope is more of a cognitive construct in which an individual believes they have whatever they need, the wherewithal to create a plan or have a goal and be able to reach that goal. So they have to feel that they have that capacity, but also that there are pathways that they can see to reach the goal. And I believe faith, I'm thinking about Hebrew chapter 11 from the Bible, that says that faith is the substance of things not yet seen. And so faith is more of a belief in some power greater than oneself or outside of oneself that may be able to co-create or create for you what it is that you are, quote, hoping for.
Jackie, this is a moment, particularly when the church itself burned down and so many things have happened this year. You said it's a hot mess. I think so many people would agree. Dumpster fire, all the things you want to call it. But faith and hope, how do we get those? How do you get faith?
Faith is a gift. I think faith is a gift that comes to us like a spiritual gift. We open up our hearts. We make ourselves available, a vessel. I think in faith communities, we discover faith, if you will. We put our children in synagogue, mosque, congregations, masjids, so that they get to rehearse faith, oversee faith, and then it becomes a part of their narrative. It grows in us, in community, in relationship, through experience, and it's a gift. Hope, to me, is about resilience. And I think hope is a practice. Hope is a practice that comes from stories. My ancestors survive, you know, the Middle Passage, and they survive chattel slavery. That story gives me hope. The people who are responding to us with so much love and support, that gives me hope. So that's how I think about them. I think they go hand in hand. I think people can have hope who don't really have faith in a deity, quite frankly. So maybe hope is this a secular practice that leads to resilience because of the stories we rehearse.
We've heard the word resilience a few times. Sonia, we've got about a minute in this part of the conversation to go, but resilience, define that for us, because it's something that gets tossed around a lot.
Right. Yeah, it's essentially a characteristic, it's a belief also, but a way of coping, really. It's a hardiness, if you will. It's a way of surviving trauma or really adverse experiences. But in surviving trauma or adverse experiences, it doesn't necessarily mean that we're thriving. And that's a concept that we talk about is post-traumatic growth, where we not just survive, but we can thrive, we can move beyond the adversity and function perhaps even better than we did before. Resilience is more the coping, making it through.
Jackie and Sonia, I have to say that our guests for me have been such a light through this year, teaching us so many things. So I'm going to ask each of you the same question. Sonia, from a psychological standpoint, how do we remain resilient? And Jackie, I'll ask you the same question from a spiritual standpoint.
Well, we're challenged right now due to the pandemic in regard to the ways that we typically build resilience, because one of the primary ways we do that is by building our support system. And, you know, we can't gather together safely. We haven't been able to do that in at least, 9 months. But building our support system is really, really important. Having some faith-based or spiritual-based practices are really, really important. Trying to take care of ourselves as best we can, getting adequate sleep, trying not to indulge in the types of things that help us to cope in the moment, like smoking or drinking, but instead trying to exercise as much as possible, to try to narrate, to change the narrative, if you will, of what has happened that we cannot change, and trying to adapt in that way while at the same time trying to change as recognize what we can change and then being able to practice doing that. That builds our sense of resilience and success in coping.
Jackie, the same question to you, Reverend.
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Tazina. I think, I like to think about psychology and faith as sort of one whole thing that somehow Western culture has separated, right? But I think resilience, and from a spiritual sense, is changing the story we tell ourselves, cultivating a belief in our ability to cope. We tell ourselves we're resilient. We tell ourselves we can get through this, and it helps us get through with it. I agree that we need to be in community. There's a sense of community resilience. You look at your neighbor and you say, today I feel unable to cope. I feel hopeless. I feel desperate. But I look at my neighbor and my neighbor's holding my hand and reminding me we can do this together. So resilience isn't an individual project. It's also a shared project. I think the third thing I'd want to say about it, and maybe thinking about Sonia too, is there's a kind of physicality to resilience. When we eat well, rest well, exercise well, our bodies are able to bounce back, which is what resilience literally means, is the ability to bounce back. So the sense of stories we tell ourselves, the sense of doing this in community, and the sense that our bodies are a temple, and if we treat our bodies well, our bodies will bounce back and help our hearts to bounce back.
The Reverend Jackie Lewis is a senior minister at Middle Collegiate Church in New York City, and Sonia Lott is a licensed psychologist specializing in grief. Sonia, Reverend Jackie, thanks to you both.
Thank you.
So good to be with you. Thank you.
It was in January 2020 that I gave birth to my son, and I became a mother for the first time. And by March, I was a new mother in the epicenter of the COVID-19 pandemic, in quarantine alone with my newborn baby. Just miles away from my apartment, Elmhurst Hospital in Queens was overflowing with grief and death. Morgue trucks piled with bodies, families howling with the pain of loss, our collective anxiety pierced by the yelling of ambulance sirens. We were forced into our homes and away from any type of social support we may have needed. And as if that weren't enough, journalists like me were under verbal assault from the federal government as we attempted to report on a democracy literally hanging in the balance. And yet we persevered, and we now stand at the precipice of a new year, one that has glimmers of hope in the form of a vaccine that might allow us to touch and even hug each other once again. This week, as our team was talking about how to end the year, our digital editor, Polly Arungu, suggested that we ask our listeners to tell us who helped them this year. And that's when I started to cry during our Zoom call. You see, the sheer exhaustion this year has wrought has been so hard on so many of us, and yet we haven't relinquished this idea of community. We haven't forgotten the wisdom of Mr. Rogers to, quote, always look for the helpers.
There will always be helpers, you know, even just on the sidelines.
And my tears were from remembering how special my own helpers were this year, especially because they weren't the people I expected to help. One person did laundry for me at a social distance. Another person brought me the best tomato I've ever had from a farmer's market. And one couple checked in via text message regularly and offered to help me baby-proof my apartment. So I decided to count my blessings and think about my helpers. And I want to thank you, Rosie and Shannon and Marlene and Stephen and Rachel and Tammy and Raisa and Catherine and Winter and Julie and Joe and Claudia and Jamie and Karen and Graciela and Joanne and Ingrid, Nicole, Jason's mom, Inez, and yes, my own mom as well. You've all shown me kindness, compassion, and grace. I also want to thank you, our listeners, who've made me laugh way out loud and also cry really hard with your honest and vulnerable stories. From the despair of a new mother burying her child, to countless examples of how you've dealt with this year, to your favorite songs, to how your pets bring you comfort, and even how you negotiate sex in a pandemic. You have made this show special. And of course, I can never forget our team here at The Takeaway who've been working endlessly from all across the country in multiple time zones to bring you this show. Our board operators are Debbie Daughtry, Claire McKean, and Vince Fairchild. Our director and sound designer is Jake Howitt. Jackie Martin, Jose Olivares, and Ethan Oberman were our line producers. Alexandra Boti is our senior producer. The Takeaway's producers are Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, and Lydia McMullen Laird. Our politics team is Amber Hall and Patricia Jacob. Katarina Barton was our intern. Polly Arungu is our digital editor. David Gable is our executive assistant. And Lee Hill is the executive producer. And finally, if this year has taught us anything, it's resilience. There was a photo in the New York Times recently by my former colleague Hiroko Matsuki, which showed a few New Yorkers huddled under a slim awning, heavy with snow, puddles of slush at their feet as they attempted to dine outdoors. For some of them at least, it may have felt for a fleeting moment normal. And it also reminded me of just how resilient we can all be, even in the face of difficult times. I wish you peace, patience, and kindness in 2021. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway.